Mid-mornings with Lee Chambers. Cambridge 105.
Time to hear now from Liz Berry, poet. Her debut collection of poetry entitled Black Country was a Poetry Book Society recommendation, received a Somerset Maugham Award and won the Forward Prize for Best First Collection in 2014. It was also chosen as a Book of the Year by numerous national newspapers. Liz now lives in Birmingham and was born in the Black Country. I asked her how important where she came from was to her.
For me, it's something that's really important and also endlessly fascinating. Interestingly, most of the poems are written when I was living away from the Black Country. And being apart from it, I felt a sort of lover's longing for it. I saw it through new eyes and I appreciated its language, its history, its landscape, the way it was in a process of transformation. And I found that it haunted my writing more and more. And I wanted to explore it, explore family stories and go back and dig into the place and see what it meant to me and what it meant to all the people that come from there.
It's a place that often gets a bad press, the Midlands, isn't it?
It is, and I think particularly the West Midlands, Birmingham and the Black Country. It was a really important industrial area and often areas that have been really important for industry and mining. Once that's left, they get a bad press, they get neglected, they get run down. I think it's really easy to forget that there are people there leading rich and interesting lives with very proud histories. They bring their family up there. There's a fascinating dialect at work there. Probably the Black Country in Birmingham, they're those places people think they know a lot about without ever having actually been there.
So what were you looking for when you were looking in it? Because you... It's not the most beautiful part of the country, though there are parts of it that are quite pretty. What were you actually sort of digging down and trying to find?
The Black Country's got this amazing story of industrial wonder and decline. It was the heart of the Industrial Revolution, a place of invention and industry and immense toil. And then that all changed, a gradual process of decline. And that in itself is really fascinating to me, the stories and the histories of the people that were part of that process. I'm fascinated by the way nature's reclaimed bits of the Black Country, the bits people might think of as being the unbeautiful bits, the old factories, the old mines, the old steelworks, where nature's now creeping in again and grown over and reclaiming. And that's something that I'm really interested in. I love the dialect and the accent. And once I started digging into those words, I discovered there was this fascinating word hoard. These wonderful, rich, gritty, exotic words. And it was just delightful to be able to play with them and use them in the poems.
Well, let's talk about the accent, because again, that gets a bit of a bad press, doesn't it? But there's a sing-song element to the accent. Do you think that influenced you in your poetry?
It does get a really bad press, doesn't it? I think year after year, it's voted the least lovely accents in the British Isles. And I think that's a terrible shame. I think it's got a great sound to it. Like you say, there's an element of the sing-song or the musical to it. It's quite guttural. There's rich and quite unexpected dialect words in there, lovely sort of thick vowels and pronunciations. And I wanted to reclaim some of that really as the stuff of poetry. There's been lots of dialect writing over the years, but lots of it's been comic or for narrative purposes. And I suppose I wanted to do something different with it. I wanted to take the language that my family had spoken and show people that that could be the stuff of lyric poetry, that it could be a beautifully eloquent language.
It is hard writing in dialect, isn't it? Because you want it to be accessible, but you want to be true to the dialect itself. How did you tread some sort of central line there?
Well, that's a really good question, because it's a hard balance to find. I think two things are important. One was that the poem should always allow the reader in, even readers that have never heard the dialect. And that means perhaps just using the odd word here or there, giving a suggestion of the voice without the full phonetics. Also, in the poems where I think it's important that the word be known to non-dialect speakers, there's a little gloss at the bottom, so you don't have to look too hard to find the meaning of the word. And I found that people have taken great pleasure in that, in discovering these new, unusual words. But it's always been so important to me that poems invite readers in and welcome readers in and allow them to be part of the experience, a part of the story that's being told.
And are there some, because of the dialect, that come alive more when they're performed?
I think there are, but I think that's often the case with poems. Some poems just lend themselves to being heard. Poetry started out as an oral art, an oral tradition, and I think when someone reads well, or there's a great connection with the audience, it can be a really exciting experience. And I think especially with poems that have an element of dialect or something musical about them, they really do come alive in performance.
Do you remember the first time you felt that connection with a poem, either one you read or one you heard?
Oh, when I was a little girl, we had a really beautiful book of poems called The Swinging Rainbow, and it was full of everything from Dylan Thomas, T.S. Eliot, folk poems, playground rhymes, right through to more contemporary poems. And we used to read it with my mum and learn some of the poems off by heart. And I remember just feeling like there was something magical in that book, something I couldn't really describe. Poems that moved me and unsettled me and made me feel that the world was full of possibilities. So if I think of when I first sort of discovered poetry and that experience, that connection, it's probably with that book.
And your first collection won the Forward Prize. How important was that to you?
Oh, it was utterly thrilling in every way. It was so unexpected. It felt like a lovely validation of the work and of the poems. I think at the time I said, what a beautiful surprise, and it really was.
Does it put pressure on you, though, for a second collection?
Well, I think everybody talks about the difficult second album, don't they? And it's probably been a strange experience for me, because just before Black Country was published, my first son was born. So it felt like lots of huge changes happened at once. I became published, I had a little boy. Life just changed in so many ways. But that also frees you to write something new and do something new and be a bit braver and try different things. Take some of the music and the language that was part of the Black Country book, some of those stories, and take them to a new place.
And I suppose having an award validates you in that you can say now, you know, I am a poet.
It does, although I always still feel a bit shy about it. Sometimes, you know, if people ask me what I do, I say, oh, you know, I'm a primary school teacher, or I stay at home with my little boy. I'm much shyer, I think, about owning it.
Could you read a poem for us?
This poem's called Homing, and I always like to think of it as a love poem to the accent and dialect of the Black Country. Homing. For years, you kept your accent in a box beneath the bed, the lock rusted shut by hours of elocution. How now, brown cow? The teacher's ruler across your legs. We heard it escape sometimes, a guttural on the phone to your sister. Saft or blart to a taxi driver, unpacking your bags from his boot. I loved its thick drawl. Geez, that rang. Clearing your house. The only thing I wanted was that box. Jemmy Dalpin. To let years of lost words spill out. Bibble. Fiddle. Tie. Wum. Vowels ferrous as nails. Consonants you could lick the coal from. I wanted to swallow them all. The pits, railways, factories thunking and clanging the night shift. The red brick back to back you were born in. I wanted to forge your voice in my mouth. A blacksmith's furnace. Shout it from the roofs. Send your words like pigeons. Fluttering for home.
Thank you. Do you know what? That rings a real bell for me, because I'm from Yorkshire, but I've lost my accent over the years. And I remember the moment when I thought it would probably be wise to start losing it, when somebody took the mickey out of me at university. But I think now we are celebrating accents more. Does it feel that way to you?
I hope so. Interestingly, that poem often rings a bell with people. I think it's about the Black Country accent and dialect, but it could be about any accent that you've had and lost. And I suppose it's about home and longing for home and identity. And I hope that we are a little bit prouder of our accents now. I know certainly they're starting to seep into the radio and TV a little bit more, which is brilliant to hear, and I think really inspiring for young people who are coming from various regions and out into the big wide world.
And what's your favourite Black Country word?
Oh, I think it's probably the word tranquilments, which means ornaments, you know, the little china shepherdesses and bits and bobs that nans might have. And for me, I love it because tranquilments, it's that perfect mix of the word tranquility and ornaments. It seems to sum up everything about them perfectly.
Oh, that's lovely, Liz Berry, the poet there. If you want to find out more about Liz's work and read some of her poetry, go to her website, which is lizberrypoetry.co.uk. Consonants you could lick the coal from. What a gift to be able to write a line like that.
Mid-mornings with Phil Rowe. Cambridge 105.
Maybe appropriate, maybe not. ABBA and the winner takes it all, because sometimes the taxman cometh and he takes, well, not all of it, but quite a proportion of it. But that's probably tax bans for another day. What's pressing, because it's coming up very soon, is the deadline for this year's self-assessment tax return. I say this year, for 2014-15, that year. That tax year closed on April the 5th. And you have until the end of this month to get all your boxes filled in and go to column C, box 6, and so on. To take some of the stress out of doing that, or in fact, perhaps advising us to do it online, if we are so inclined, is our guest this morning. It's John Burling. It's nice to have him back. He hasn't been around for a little while.
Good morning. No, it does seem like quite a while. I wasn't allowed early on in the year when we had an election during that period of Purdue. I'm not allowed to be on the radio, but here I am back again.
They locked you down, John, at that time, yes.
And they've let me loose again.
Yep. And now all that kind of the political hot water is out of the way for you as a sort of responsible government officer.
That's correct.
You wanted to show impartiality and lack of political bias at the time, or not be seen to be quoted for something. So,
well, that's correct. But here I am back again with my usual self-assessment messages.
That's right. And we want to get that in before the next week. I'm just looking at my watch. The next 3 weeks.
Yes.
Really?
Well, it all depends. It must be remembered that not everyone has to think about self-assessment returns, because if you're in a pay-as-you-earn job, it's a basic, straightforward job. You've got no company car, no benefits in kind, no expenses. You probably won't be covered by self-assessment. And 2/3 of the working population are not covered by self-assessment. But the third that are, we're now approaching some serious deadlines.
People like company directors, they must do that.
That's correct.
There's no option for them. They have to include that. People who have dividends or property.
That's correct. Look, there are a certain group of people, self-employed people, whether as a sole trader or in partnership.
And when we say property, not panicking people, those have got mortgages and living in their own homes. We're talking about property portfolios. So they may be buy-to-let individuals.
Well, basically, you're talking about anyone who, as I say, is self-employed in a partnership, that kind of thing, directors of limited companies, or they own more than just their own home. If you've got your own house and you've got a mortgage on it, well, that's fair enough. But if you own a second property and you're renting that out, or you own some land that you're renting out, or perhaps, as you say, you do run a business of renting out holiday homes, these kinds of things, especially near the coast, that kind of thing, then you're going to have to fill out a self-assessment form to let us know the information specific to your circumstances.
And if you had some overseas investments as well, they would need to go down.
It can be overseas investment. I mean, there's also a box for if you're a Lloyd's trustee and all things like that. So self-assessment covers, I think there's about 8 or 9 different types of individual. It can be actually, if you've got complicated affairs, let's say you've got 2 pensions and you work part-time and you've got foreign income and you've got dividends, then that kind of thing can get a bit tricky. So self-assessment pulls it all together. But that's when we decide it's easier for somebody to be in self-assessment.
Now, is it my responsibility as an individual, as a taxpayer, John, to decide whether I should have a self-assessment tax return, or is the onus on HMRC to decide and send us the form?
The onus is on us, provided somebody tells us. For example, if someone is self-employed and they start self-employment, they let us know and they register to pay their own self-employed national insurance contributions. We then automatically put them on self-assessment. But if we don't know someone's self-employed, we're not going to know that the fact that we've got to send them a self-assessment return. So if somebody is just starting out self-employment, let's say they're starting today, they might think, oh my God, I've got to do a self-assessment. That's not the case, because all you do is letting us know you're self-employed. At the end of the first tax year, which is next April the 5th, that's when we will contact you about your self-assessment form. And that's why, as you quite rightly said, the people that need to think about it now are those that were self-employed or company directors or whatever in the tax year ending the 5th of April 2015. That's the tax year that we now want to know all your information.
And this will be a sizeable wodge when it, if it does arrive through your letterbox, the dreaded brown envelope, I suppose. But it's a large letter and it contains a serious number of sheets of paper.
It all depends your circumstances. The main form is about 10 or 12 pages long and everyone does the same information on those. The pages at the back will then be reflectant upon your personal circumstances. If you're self-employed as a sole trader, you have the orange pages. If you're self-employed in a partnership, you have the blue pages. If you've got foreign income, I believe they're brown. So they're all different colour coordinated based upon your circumstances. And the more, I suppose, things you've got going on, the more in your life, the more types of income. And you can have £2 you earn jobs, £2 you earn, you know, self-employed incomes. You'll get more pages at the back. But of course, we don't actually automatically issue those now because, as you said at the beginning, as a department, we're trying to encourage everybody to do it online. So we send people a letter to tell them to do it online. But if they then contact us and say, well, actually, I still want to do a paper return, then they phone us up, we send them a paper return, and that's the deadline, which is fast approaching.
So now then, John, the HMRC policy for the UK then is not to send someone out the paperwork, the self-assessment tax return, by post enclosed. So the default now then is to, well, I won't say expect, but shall we say, sway people towards doing it electronically in the instance?
Well, yes. We send everybody, 10 million self-assessment taxpayers, a letter about their tax form. So everyone gets the same letter initially. And you're right, we are trying to recommend, we are trying to encourage people to do it online. But the letter quite clearly says, if you do not want to do it online, we are happy with that. Give us a phone call back. We will then send you the paper return. Then you've got the paper return to do. It's the same information. It produces the same tax results. Doesn't mean you pay any more or any less tax. It's exactly the same. The only difference is you're putting the information on a bit of paper and posting it back to us, as opposed to doing it online, pressing a button, and it comes over the internet. But the end result is exactly the same.
Something like you were saying to me off air before we started this, one statistic here is 88% of us do file electronically now for our private affairs with the tax man at this time.
That's correct. When we first introduced it, it was about 3%, then 10%, then 33%. And the latest figure for the last year was about 88% of people do it online. Not because they have to, but because they've chosen to. It means they can do it a little bit, leave it, go back to it. Leave it, go back to it. They can think, oh, I've done that wrong. No, I'll change that. I'll put in different figures. They can do it on a Sunday afternoon. They can do it 12 o'clock at night. They can even do it Christmas Day. And last year, there was 824 people that did it Christmas Day.
I thought you'd carry that statistic in your head, John. Carry so many statistics around in there.
A lot of people say, oh, isn't that sad? But actually, I think that's rather clever. Because if you, heaven forbid, leave it until the dreaded last day, as lots of people do,
January the
31st, people press a button and they wait and they wait and they get a little egg timer and they wait and they wait. And sometimes it takes a good few hours to be processed. Do it on Christmas Day. 5 seconds later, it's processed because there's 824. There's not 800,000. But the most important thing at the moment is actually the paper forms. Because if somebody is going to do it by paper, they've got until the 31st of October to get it back in. So if that person is sitting there thinking, yes, I want to do it by paper, but I haven't got the paper form, they've got to ring up the self-employed helpline and make sure that the form is actually sent to them quickly so they can get it back to us quickly by the 31st of October.
And that's the receive by date, not the post off date.
That's correct. Although we are quite generous. If it's a Monday morning and we receive it, say the 31st is a Sunday and we receive it on the Monday morning, then yes, we've got the 1st of November, but because 31st fell over a weekend, we will probably not charge them a penalty. But that's us being generous. That's not the legislation saying that. That's us applying a bit of common sense. But again, why leave it to that? Why run the risk? Because let's say you post it and it gets lost in the post and it arrives 2 weeks later. You're running a risk. Let's say you want to post it, but you fall ill yourself and you can't get out to post it. You're running a risk. So I always make the point, yes, we have these deadlines, but actually get it into us way before the deadline so you're not running any risk.
Some reassurance here for people that don't have a computer at home. They're not online. They don't have a router or broadband or whatever, any form of electronic means in their house. There are people that choose to live their lives like that. The people that don't want a television in their home.
That's true.
So therefore, not going to be filing online. Some reassurance, though, from the government. They have no plans to remove the paper versions of the self-assessment tax return.
No plans at the moment. There are some things they have introduced. For example, if you're a business and you have a VAT return to do, the dreaded VAT return, because most businesses now deal electronically, have websites, etc., etc., that is compulsory to be done online. But as an individual, your own self-assessment form, there are no plans that I have heard of that have been announced by anybody to make it compulsory online. So there's still that option, and there is still going to be that option to do it by paper.
And I know in 2010, Prime Minister David Cameron, who was in power at that time, said to, again, an Older People's Federation that campaigned the government to make sure that checkbooks weren't lost. And it's not actually a taxation issue, but for older people who don't do online banking, electronic crediting or BACS or anything like that in their lives, then they can still write good old-fashioned checks. So the paper self-assessment tax
return, it all ties in together, doesn't it?
Is here to stay for quite a while longer.
But it's also the payment as well, because the self-assessment is just the information about your business, how much profit you've made, how much you've earned. If you're going to be then due a payment of tax, then again, we encourage people to pay electronically because it's quicker, it goes through, it's safer. But we've still received lots of checks from individuals, from companies to settle their tax affairs.
And the other thing, John, is the advantages of filing online. First of all, reassure people, obviously, that they are not necessarily having to do that. But for those that do, then there's the advantage of calculations, which the piece of software that they're using or sort of interfacing with gives.
That's correct. There's a few advantages. One of them is that if you are due a tax refund, now there's lots of people for various reasons might be due a refund. If you do it online, I've known people to get their tax refund within 5 to 7 working days. It is that quick, automated process. If you're due a refund and you do it by paper, we've got to wait for all the paper returns to be received and then literally go through them one by one. So that takes a little bit longer. The other advantage is that, as I say, you can do it whenever you want. You're running no risks of things getting lost in the post. Also, if you do it by paper, you won't know how much tax you owe until we process it and send a letter back to you to tell you how much tax you owe. You do it online and it appears instantaneously on screen. Before you send it to us, a little box come up, view statement. So the statement is there and it shows you how much you owe before it even comes to us.
And if people choose, they can print it out in a good old-fashioned way, have a physical copy at home.
Yep.
Or a PDF, so they can save that somewhere.
You can save it as a PDF or HTML, or don't ask what HTML stands for. You probably know much more about that than me.
Hyperterminal something. We'll have a listener who'll tell us what it's one of those general knowledge questions. One of our techie boys will tell me.
Or you can print it out and you can have it. And there are lots of people that, although it's still held digitally, they still like their bit of paper. But once you save it, it's saved permanently there for you.
That's the way, isn't it? So, of course, electronically, the other advantage, you have until January the 31st, as you said, but don't leave it till the last minute.
I know lots of people who have already done their returns. They do it electronically. It's already processed because they don't want to leave it until later in January in case their own computer goes wrong, in case there's 1 million people doing it online in one go. So they get rid of it, get it out of the way.
It's a bane of our life, John, but let's get people started on it at least. And finally, if you're not registered for the government gateway, this is how to do it, because before you can go electronic, you do have to register with the government.
Well, the first thing is, can I just give the self-assessment helpline telephone number? That's 0300 200 3310. 0300 200 3310. It's open Monday to Friday, 8 till 8, and even on the Saturday from 8 till 4 p.m. If, however, you're thinking of changing from paper to internet, then you have to go onto the website. Now, we used to have a HMRC website. Now, it is all part of www.gov.uk. You literally just type in self-assessment, excuse me, type in self-assessment, and the page comes up, and it's a simple step-by-step process that you have to then register. You get an activation pin and you're up and running.
Hey ho, simple as that.
Simple as that.
Well, at least it seems that
way. It sounds that way.
it sounds that way, yeah. And, of course, you need to allow time for that as well. So get that out of the way maybe before Christmas so that you're registered. Gives you, say, January or even before to get the whole thing up.
And that's why if I go to radio stations, I go in early January. I don't go in on the 30th or the 31st because it's almost too late by then. So I go in early January, get it done, get it out of the way so you've got plenty of time.
John, you've got a lot of listeners now setting to.
I can hear those keyboards tapping away tapping even as we speak.
To get this all sorted out. So that helpline number again, 0300 200 3310. 0300 200 3310. Or go to where everything is all under one roof now, all in one place.
Gov.uk.
Gov.uk. It's as simple as that. It's the government website where things hopefully can be trusted.
That's correct.
Somebody we trust very much is John Burling from the HMRC Cambridge. John, come back and see us again.
Of course,
soon.
I'll always come back.
You'll
thank you for having me.
Plenty of topics. Yes. I know. But you can all catch what John just said again in our podcast next week from the best of the guests available from Monday. John, thank you very much.
That's okay.
From 1 till 4, Afternoons with Matt Webb. Cambridge 105.
So my guest this afternoon is the Mill Road coordinator, Franny Ritchie. She's going to be updating us with all the things going on along the Mill Road Mile. Good afternoon to you.
Hi, Matt.
How's your week been?
It's been good.
Busy.
Well, I'm 2 months in post now, so I'm starting to get the hang of it.
Right, and you've got some family down as well, haven't you, at the moment?
Yeah, my parents are in town.
Keeping you company. So lots of things to talk about this month, including the Mill Road entry into the Great British High Street competition. Tell us more.
Okay, well, my predecessor, Carrie Littlechild, did this on her way out the door. She entered us in the Great British High Street competition, and we found out last week that we've been shortlisted. So we're up against two other high streets in the city's competition, Bradford's North Parade and St. Giles Street, Northampton. And there's two parts to the way that the winner will finally be assessed. One is a crowdsourced vote. That'll be half of it. And the other is a judging panel is going to be coming down to Mill Road at some point in the next 6 weeks. And when I spoke to their representative, she said, whatever song and dance you want to do. So that's that's their phrasing, not mine. But we're in the midst of choreographing our song and dance, if you want to put it that way, for when the judges come in the next few weeks.
So what's the criteria to be able to enter this competition then? What do you have to be able to prove?
Well, I think Carrie really pitched our entry around three things. One is the growth and sort of the ascent, if you like, of the Traders Association. The other is the amount of interconnectedness of the various traders, regardless of whether or not they're part of the Traders Association, sort of how much trader-to-trader networking there is. Mm. And then the third thing is the sort of ascent of new media, how savvy we're increasingly becoming at using communications and social media. So those are the three things that were kind of our pitch. And I think it's kind of up to us as to how we carry on sort of presenting ourselves to the judges panel. As far as the vote goes, though, all we need people to do is just turn up and vote. Like, there's no pitch there. We just need people to show up, if that makes sense.
Well, I'll get you to give the details on how to vote in just a second, but you say it involves social media, so I would take it Facebook and Twitter are proving quite crucial for you and the Mill Road guys at the moment.
Yeah, well, actually, shortly after the finalists were announced, Mill Road was actually trending on Twitter, sort of UK-wide, very briefly. So I think that's a real testament to how cultivated our social media presence is and how hard we've worked to build it. So that was really, really exciting. But yeah, yes, is the short answer. It's been really important, and we're hoping that people will continue to support us on social media.
Are you using a hashtag then?
Yeah, it's two things, hashtag Mill Road and hashtag GB High Street.
Okay, so do make sure that if you're going to a Tweet Mill Road, obviously use those hashtags, because obviously it helps sort of boost the profile as well.
Absolutely.
So if someone's listening and think, yes, I do go shopping on Mill Road, I go and see Mr. G's or the Cambridge Bed Centre or whoever, and go and get my bits and pieces from there, how can they cast their vote for Mill Road?
Right, you just go to thegreatbritishhighstreet.co.uk, and we've been promoted. We entered in the local high street, local centre competition, but we got promoted to the city's competition, which I think is a marvelous promotion because it means that we're at the top of the listing. So go to thegreatbritishhighstreet.co.uk, click on vote, and then you don't even need to scroll. There's another vote for the city's category right at the top, and you just need to click on that, and it'll take you right to where you need to go. So the whole thing takes about 5 seconds. You can vote every single day, and please do, from now until November 13th.
So there's no sort of like geo-blocking or anything if you end up sort of casting the vote from the same IP address every day?
No, as far as we know, there are no restrictions on IP addresses, so it's one vote per email address per day. So, yeah, I have, with my mum's blessing, voted on her behalf once, for example.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, as far as we know, if you've got three email addresses, just boom, 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 do them all, and we'd be very grateful for your support.
Well, we wish you best of luck with that, and obviously Thank do you. Let us know how you get on. Mm-hmm. And obviously something else that's going to be coming up in December, it's the annual Mill Road Winter Fair.
It is. We're very excited.
So what's going to be happening regarding that? Obviously preparations must be very much underway for that at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the amazing thing about the Winter Fair that I didn't realize until I became coordinator is it is almost entirely volunteer coordinated and run. So I've been giving support to the group of volunteers, and I've been working with the traders as they prepare sort of their own song and dance for the Winter Fair. But the events themselves, all the buskers, all of the events, all of the special activities that you see on Mill Road have all been coordinated entirely by a volunteer organization. And they're very much sort of full speed ahead now from now until December. So there's going to be busking from 10 to 4. There's going to be a Christmas pudding race on Parker's Peak.
Christmas pudding race?
There is, yeah. Kind of like an egg race. Kind of like an egg race, but a Christmas pudding race. And I think that's in conjunction with a major charity that's unfortunately slipping my mind at the moment. So that'll be on Parker's Peak, sort of kitty corner to Mill Road, just as the festival's getting underway. What else? There's going to be all the usual bits and bobs. You know, the things that happen every year will be happening again this year.
So there'll be like stands on Donkey Green and Ditchburn Place, for example.
Yeah, exactly. There are a number of new businesses opening up on Mill Road in the next 3 months, and they'll be making sort of their first stand to the public, including, for example, Sam at Calverley's Brewing. There's a brewery that's been on Hooper Street for about a year, but they've just opened to the public over the summer. They'll have a stand there. That'll be one of their first big sort of publicity ploys. Sort of all of the usual good things and some new stuff as well.
Now, obviously, there's going to be a leaflet or a brochure that's going to be published. If someone, for example, wants to become a partner and sort of wants to get their details in the brochure, is there a deadline at all for getting that to be sort of printed?
Roughly mid-October, yeah. So in the next week or two. And I'm probably the person to contact about it. millroadcoordinator@gmail.com, and I can make sure that I signpost you to the right person. As far as receiving the leaflets, there will be volunteers that'll be posting them in Romsey and Petersfield in the weeks leading up to the Mill Road Winter Fair.
Okay.
So if you want to get one, don't worry, it's coming. If you want to be in it, yeah, I'm the person to speak to, and I can make sure that we point you in the right direction.
And of course, Cambridge 105 will hopefully be broadcasting from the event again this year.
I was assuming you would be there, yeah.
We were talking about it last night at our management meeting, actually. That's one reason why I brought up the issue surrounding the programme, so at least I know that as well.
Yep.
And what else is happening on Mill Road over the next couple of weeks then?
Yeah, well, the other big event is the Festive Light Switch On. That'll be Saturday, the 14th of November. We've got a few things underway that we're not quite ready to reveal for 2016.
And that's the day before the main city centre light switch on Market Square. So
yeah,
the two don't clash, which is good.
Right, right. The Grafton Centre happens on the Saturday at 4 p.m. The city centre ones happen on Sunday, sort of late afternoon time. And then ours is going to be 5:30, 6 o'clock. So you can make all of them. The Grafton Centre will be shut down by the time ours is happening. You're not going to be missing anything at the Grafton Centre. And the city centre is going to be the next day as well. So you can hit them all. You can make a big weekend out of it.
So what sort of things are going to be happening at the Christmas lights, which obviously the lights are going to come on, but
yeah,
have you got any sort of like music, live music or anything?
Absolutely. We're going to have Argo Iris, who were there next year, the
The Samba Band.
Samba Band, yes. Yep. And we're going to have some food. The lights are obviously the main attraction. There are going to be some other sort of family-friendly events as well. It's going to be, actually, this is important to note, the St. Barnabas tree that has historically been sort of the centerpiece of the Mill Road Festival Lights was taken down this spring. It was damaged in a storm. So we're looking to light up a tree in the Great Eastern Street car park. So it's going to be in a completely different location this year, but just over the bridge, you know, less than a 3-minute walk away, actually.
And are you still seeking funding for the... For the Mill Road Lights?
Yes, we're very close. We're very, very close, but we would be absolutely hugely grateful for any support that any community members might like to share with us.
Okay, excellent stuff. So if people want to get in contact with you, perhaps they'd like to get involved in quite a few things that are going to be happening over the next couple of weeks mm-hmm. and couple of months, how would they go about getting in touch with you?
Yeah, well, the easiest way to do it is at millroadcoordinator@gmail.com, but I can also be reached on Twitter at @millroadco, on Instagram at @millroadcoordinator, or on Facebook at @millroadcoordinator. And I have a city council email address as well. It's francis.ritchie@cambridge.gov.uk. And this is my hood. So if you're Mill Road local and you see me walking down the street, definitely grab
me. Sounds like a song, doesn't it, actually? I saw you walking down the street the other day down Sturton Street, which shows how local you really are.
It definitely has happened, yeah.
Excellent stuff. Well, thank you very much, Franny, and we'll have a chat with you again in a month's time. Thank you for coming into Cambridge 105.
Yeah, thank you.
Cheers.
Mid-mornings with Mike Pryor. Cambridge 105.
My guest has now arrived, Tina Roach. Tina is the managing director and founding partner of Cambridge Cookery School, together with Liz, I think I'm right in saying?
That's correct.
When was it you that wasn't a bee, that was Tina's phone. way back when you founded the school, I think.
So I founded it on my own, very much a one-woman sort of business, started literally from around my own kitchen table 8 years ago. And now we, as I told you, I've just come from the rather chaotic scene that is our moved cookery school, completely newly kitted out with amazing new generation Neff ovens and a cafe and a bakery, which receives its first corporate client tomorrow night.
Oh.
So I am... little tense about that.
We'll be quick so we can get back to work.
We've come a long way in 7 years, it is, I guess.
Now, the thing is, we can't go on talking without mentioning something that happened last night. And sadly, Ian from Cambridgeshire didn't win. We won't mention who did win in case people are listening who haven't heard who the winner was. Mm-hmm. But that surely must... I mean, they were saying that it's been 11 million people, one of the highest-rated programs in terms of people watching of anything on the TV at the moment. So that must reflect on what you're seeing in terms of your business, I would have guessed.
Well, obviously, the whole interest in not just baking, but also cooking is enormous, isn't it, at the moment? So the bake-off, yes, of course, it's certainly, I think, spurned a whole generation to start baking again, which has to be good news. I think that's wonderful.
Why do you think it's captured people's imagination so much then?
Well, it's reality TV, isn't it? And that seems to be what everybody wants. I personally have issues, I have to say, about turning food into a competition because it's so far from what it's all actually about. And I also sometimes debate whether, you know, out of those 11.5 million people who watched, how many actually then turn to their pantry and start baking. I think there's a curious phenomenon in so many people watching people that they have never met in their life create food that they will never eat, only for them to go and put something in the microwave and wait for a minute for it to ping. I'm not sure.
But it's fascinating to watch, though, isn't it?
Absolutely fascinating. Yeah. And I think the people who go on and manage, the pressure is huge. I think they do so well. And what I really enjoy is you see that, you know, from the first program where you think, oh, who will go through and so on, everybody starts speculating. But I think it's fascinating to see that there's obviously a core skill, a core ability in some, and they just grow so much in confidence and competence throughout the competition. So those that were there last night have all come so much further than where they were when they entered, and to see that confidence grow, I think, is fascinating. They just seem to absorb every single mistake, is absorbed and turned into a positive, and I think that's the skill in those who go through.
And maybe that's something that we can sort of take from that show and just employ ourselves in our own kitchens.
I
guess, really.
I think so.
Now, you write an article for Cambridge News every month, and the last one that you did, I think, was on baking bread, wasn't it?
Yes.
And I must say, we've got some bread in the studio, so we'll be having a try of that in a moment. But it was interesting. I was reading the article, and in there you say the word alchemy is defined as the process of taking something ordinary and turning it into something extraordinary. You also say this perfectly sums up the process of making bread, where the basic ingredients of water, flour, yeast and salt can be transformed into something so utterly delicious.
Mm.
And it is amazing, really, isn't it, to think that those basic ingredients, you know, everybody, when you walk past a bakery, everybody loves the smell of it and so on. You also said that the earliest evidence of the existence of flour dates back some 30,000 years. So do you reckon that we've been making bread in one form or another for that length of time?
It's not what I reckon, it's a fact. We know that. We know that basic grains were ground into, I mean, we're talking very, very basic breads here, and they would have been unleavened. So in those four ingredients, you could still, in the case of many flatbreads around the world, take out one of the four, because you actually don't need yeast to make bread either. So you really are just talking about a crudely ground grain, water and a bit of salt. You know, you could take out the salt too, but it becomes a very tasteless bread. But it is so basic, and yet it transforms, as I say, in an almost alchemic way. And for me, bread is a lifelong passion, and the reason that I think it's infinitely more interesting than baking cakes is that for me, baking a cake is assembling various things in the correct way, in a very exact way. You have to have a very exact mind to be a good baker. And then it will turn out a certain way. But you are just assembling ingredients. With bread, you're dealing with a live organism. It is never the same. You're always, you know, putting life into something, certainly if you're baking with yeast. They're all in there, these millions of little yeast organisms. They're all around us, and they're just ready to be captured and kicked into action. So my bread today is not going to be exactly the same as my bread tomorrow or the day after. And that is what I think is wonderful about bread.
Oh, really? So in terms of mass production, because I want to talk a little bit about that as well.
Yes.
You know, where manufacturers are involved in producing something to supply to shops and so on, I would have thought consistency is something that is vital for their business.
Absolutely, and therefore all character has had to be taken out of it. So when the Chorleywood method was introduced in the UK in around 1962 or three, I think, that was what allowed commercial bread to be made, so that you can start mixing a dough and you can have a bread sliced in a plastic bag about 3 hours later. The traditional method, as we know when we go to, say, to the continent where baking is alive and well, is that a baker might have left his shop in the afternoon with all the doughs set for the morning. He will then come in early in the morning and bake. A good bread will need at least 12 to 24 hours to mature slowly. You can't do that on a commercial scale. So instead, we have a method which has taken all character and all nutritional value. Bread is incredibly healthy if it's properly made. Taken that out and turned it into what I would call a quasi-product. It's called bread, but it isn't bread. Yeah. And it is very, very bad for us.
It's almost like a convenience food, really, isn't it?
I would almost not go as far as call some of the breads food. Right. I think they are not, I'm not being funny here, they're actually not fit for human consumption.
Right.
And if you look at those three ingredients I just listed, compared to pick up a bread, a sliced bread, I won't mention any names, but a big brand, and you might find 17, 18 ingredients in there listed. They're all unnecessary and they're all bad for us.
Are they there more for just preservation, to keep the bread, you know, edible for a longer period?
That's right. That's why it never molds or go dry. It's full of chemicals.
Right. And you know, certainly when I was a youngster, that they would say to you, oh, you must eat brown bread because it's more healthy for you and so forth. Would you agree with that, even on mass-produced bread?
No. Absolute myth.
Really?
It might be. There's a negligible increase in fiber if you're buying brown bread, but commercially baked brown breads, For a kernel to be healthy, it needs to be intact. You've got all the three component parts of a kernel that you get in full corn, whole corn breads, often those flat German ones. You know, you can see the grains, can't you? A commercial bread labelled wholemeal, there is so little difference in the nutritional value that you can forget about it.
Oh, really?
You might as well, if you have a little slice of red pepper or perhaps an extra piece of broccoli, you know, you've got your fibre intake up much more than the bread. So that is a myth, and it's just a con to make us think that we're buying a healthy bread. We're not.
Okay, so you can obviously buy bread other than sliced bread in bakeries and so on. And I know we used to have lots of holidays in France, and you know, you'd go over there into the boulangerie and so forth, and you'd never, virtually never, find what we would describe as sliced bread there. It's all, you know, if it's baguettes or whatever else that they sell. It tends to be much more traditional there. And you mentioned yourself about on the continent, sliced bread, is that not so popular as it is in the UK?
Because it's handmade, right. Still increasingly. If you go into a big supermarket in France or Italy, you could buy some sliced bread. But by and large, you know, people want to be in control of their own bread. Thank you very much. You know, they'll decide whether they're going to break it or slice it, or put it in, you know, put it in chunks and dry it out and put it in a salad. Slicing is obviously very much because we like to either toast it or make sandwiches, where people don't eat like that on the continent. So I suppose the sliced bread is very much geared to the British like for toast and sandwiches.
Making bread, though, it's, I mean, you do it. I know you said you have a passion for bread. Making bread, I think, for a lot of people is a bit of a dark art, though, isn't it? I know when we've tried in the past to make bread, as you said yourself, it often comes out very different to the previous time, and most times it's pretty naff, to be fair. So what's the secret of making good bread?
The secret is simply being taught what it is you're doing and understanding the process and where the pitfalls are. And obviously there is a huge interest in it, because our programme for 2016, 32, I think, out of our Sundays next year are baking Sundays at the cookery school, and I know they'll all be fully sold. In fact, they're selling out now. There's a huge interest in baking bread, and I think, as you said, it goes back so many thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. I see in people, when they start kneading with us, kneading a dough, it's like you're turning on a switch, and people tend to, I think, literally feel, hang on a minute, this is something I should be doing. This is right somehow. It's a hugely satisfying process, kneading, and you're aware that you're making something that possibly is ingrained somewhere in our DNA. We have made bread for tens of thousands of years, since we became, if you like, human beings. Bread has been part of us. So there's a huge interest in it. And once you understand what yeast is and how it works, it is the easiest thing to do. And contrary to perhaps popular belief, the lovely focaccia you see in front of you, it took me 5 minutes to weigh it up and mix it last night. I then left it to slow rise in the fridge, so I didn't give the yeast a chance to go bonkers. I kept it in a cold environment, which means it's retarded, yeah, and then you get a better dough.
Again,
then this morning, I baked it.
Just mention that, because again, that's in your article. That, yes. I was really surprised to see that.
Most people are.
Well, yeah, because everybody seems to think, oh, you know, again, you know, when I was a child and we had a coal fire and so on, you'd make a bowl with yeast in it, with the dough in, rather, and put it in front of the fire with a tea towel over the top to allow it to rise. Mm. But you're saying that's not the best way.
It's not. You can certainly do it that way if you want to have bread, you know, within an hour of mixing your dough. But gluten, which is an interesting subject, but the gluten in bread, the traditional way, where it's left to sit for maybe anything from 12 to sort of 24 hours, the gluten then breaks down in a way that it doesn't if you make bread very quickly. And it can be more easy to digest. I'm not saying it makes the bread gluten-free. It certainly doesn't. But the chemical structure of the gluten will change. And you will also eventually, if you leave a bread dough for long enough, it will start to develop a little bit of acidity. So that's some of what a sourdough has. And it becomes a better bread to digest. It becomes a healthier bread, and it becomes a tastier bread. So just making 5 minutes in the previous night, you chuck it in a plastic bag in the fridge, you really pour it out. I've given you a sample dough there to show how loose a dough should be. And then it proves while you wait for your oven to come up to temperature, and then you bake it. So, if I say so myself, a stunning looking focaccia like that. My input is about 5 minutes.
Right, and so Tina's given me a plastic bag, as she was saying here, with this is really quite a very fluid state. Not what I would have expected. I would have thought it would have been a much more stiff consistency than it is. Is this the consistency you would have it in to then when you put it in the fridge?
So that is one of the first mistakes, that people tend to put far too much flour in the dough at home, and every extra gram of flour is obviously going to contribute to an eventual very dry bread. So the looser the dough, the higher the water ratio in your dough can be, the better your bread is going to be. And artisan bakers tend to show off a little bit about talking about how many percentages of their dough is in fact a liquid. It's a bit of a show off thing, really, because it's the more liquid it is, the more difficult it is to handle, and it makes a better bread. So
right, because this was the next question I was going to say. Seeing how I would describe it. It's difficult to know how to describe it in terms of its consistency, but it's very fluid. To try and knead that must be incredibly difficult, is it?
But there is a technique. You actually sort of throw it rather than get your hands stuck into the dough, because then it will eventually become a part of
you. You just have it all
over
your hands, won't you?
But the hydration rate, which is the official term for it, is probably about between 75 and 80% in that. And I think a lot of people end up with a hydration rate of about 50, 60 water to flour when they bake at home. And it's just far too dry to ever make a good bread.
Right. So what is the absolute key thing that you need to do when you is it the mix, is it the amount of moisture in it, or is it the kneading, or is it the resting time? What's the most important
thing?
Well,
all of those are important, but what I can say categorically is that an under-kneaded bread will never be as good as a properly kneaded bread. It's difficult to over-knead, certainly, but you can definitely damage your bread by under-kneading. So kneading is the stage when you are creating what we think of as gluten. You're actually making long strands which will hold your bread together and which will allow the yeast to develop in the bread. So if you under-knead, the bread will be flat and dull. And if you have too much flour on top of that, then you're creating a bit of a doorstop of a bread, which is never going to be enjoyable to eat. But kneading is probably the one thing that is very important. But you know, slow rising also makes a big difference, as I say. And then there is a time for proving where, in fact, if you overprove, you've lost it. You know, you had a perfect dough there, but you waited too long and you're starting to lose its qualities. So proving is important too. But there are just a few key elements. And once you've got your hands on it and you have that hand feel, if you like, tour de main is a French word for it, you just know what you're after from then on, and you will have perfect bread day in and day out. It really, really isn't difficult. Making a good cupcake is much more difficult than making a good bread once you understand what's going on.
And different flours, because you've brought in some focaccia for us to try today. Is the flour that you'd use for that different to, say, making a crusty loaf?
No, not necessarily, but all bread flour is very different from cake or pastry flour. So you know how we all want a light pastry, and you know people often talk about warm hands are bread hands and cold hands and cold surfaces are for pastry. The point about pastry is that you do not want any gluten development. So you want, because it's making it tough, so you want plain flour, which comes from a wheat which has lower levels of protein, which means lower levels of gluten. So you have a flour which, no matter how long you knead it, will never really give that much stretchiness and hold. So that's exactly what you want in a light pastry, you can imagine. In a bread, it's the opposite. You'll need a very strong wheat with a lot of gluten in it, so that when you mix the flour with the liquid, whether it's water going into your dough or milk or whatever it is, it will form those strands that become what we tend to think of as gluten. And that is, if you can imagine, the scaffolding of your bread, which is why if you're baking with gluten-free flour, you cannot knead. It is impossible, because you take gluten out of a flour mix, there is nothing that will give it hold. So then you put in other things like xanthan gum and other things that will give it elasticity. But you cannot knead in a traditional way a gluten-free dough.
Mm. It sounds very technical to me, I have to say.
It isn't really.
You mentioned before your classes. You run a number of classes for bread making is very high in popularity.
It is, you know, we start at beginner's bread. They tend to sell out at the moment they go on our website, basically. And then we move over to slightly more advanced breads, where perhaps, you know, introducing enriched breads, which will have a bit of milk, egg, that sort of thing, in the butter, in the dough. And then we move across to sourdough, which is obviously a fascination to a lot of people, and what I would say the king of breads, and also all the great French pastries. So people can come and learn to make their own croissants and spreads like that, which of course is hugely exciting.
Well, listen, thanks ever so much for coming in, as always. If people would like to get more information about, you know, how you can help them and so on, how can they do that?
They can look at the CambridgeCookeryschool.com website.
Great, there you go. That's Tina. She's going to hopefully leave with me some of that bread that she's brought in, that focaccia. It's huge, I have to say.
Are you not going to try a piece?
Yes, but not whilst I'm talking. That's the thing. Tina, thanks ever so much for coming in. I appreciate that.
Mid-mornings with Lee Chambers. Cambridge 105.
Normally, I just have one guest here, but I've got three people sitting opposite me, which is lovely, here to talk about Circuit Unlock Cambridge. I've got Tahara.
Hi.
I've got Lou.
Hi.
And Jacob.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the mid-morning show. Now, first of all, let's just start with the basics. You're all from Circuit. Tell me a little bit about Circuit, Tahara.
Sure. Well, I'm the Circuit Programme Manager. Circuit's a programme run jointly with Kettles Yard and Wising Arts Centre. We're the Young People's Programme at the galleries. We're part of a national network of galleries who run the Circuit Programme, and it's overly led by the Tate. And the main purpose is to engage more 15 to 25 year olds with the work that we do in the galleries, but particularly by allowing them to be the producers. So Jacob and Lou from the group are essentially producing the whole of the Circuit programme and the Circuit Festival.
So Jacob and Lou, have you been involved with Circuit for some time?
Yes, I mean, I've been involved for Circuit just under a year now, and it's been really great in terms of giving me opportunities for doing creative things in terms of what I'm interested in, my own kind of media, I guess, and as well, like, free trips to galleries. I mean, there was one time we went to the Whitworth in Manchester,
yeah,
and that, you know, for the opening of that, which was, you know, fantastic. And it's just a really great way of getting involved with stuff and being proactive about being creative.
And have you found that as well, Lee?
Yes, I've been part of the Circuit programme for about 2 years, so pretty much since it started here between Kettles Yard and Boising. And like Jacob said, it offers really great opportunities. The reopening of the Whitworth was amazing. And where else have I been? Been to Wales.
And these are all things
that are partner
related
organisations.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably worth saying as well that it's also like a really great thing in terms of if you want to get involved in the arts as a career or in any of these things, in like that kind of walk of life. Like for example, one of the last things we did was the gallery takeover. The Murmuration, sorry. And you know, all the members of the Circuit, we actually put on the event at Kettles Yard. Like, we organised the music, we organised the spoken words, we like sort of set out the lighting, and we did everything that. And I think those kinds of opportunities are really great to put on CVs and stuff like that, because they can, you can apply them to all sorts of creative industry.
So are you two interested, Lou and Jacob, are you interested in working in the arts?
Yeah, I'd say, we sort of already do in some ways.
I work at Wising Arts Centre, which is one of the partner groups. So,
are you an artist or?
Wouldn't go so far that way, but I sort of help with the sort of operations side of things, so making sure things happen.
What about you, Jake?
And I work part time at Wising as well as the site and technical assistant, and I also work at the Cambridge Junction, just as a steward or bar member. But they both kind of go hand in hand in some respects, because it's both in that world. And when you, I mean, for me, coming out of university, I studied music at Anglia Ruskin. It's just like, you've got to get in there somewhere, and to start by doing this, it's great. And, you know, to be doing something you're interested in as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what more could you ask for?
Because at Kettles Yard and Wising, we work with young people in the Circuit programme to both help them in the sort of their creative pursuits and being creative producers, but we also have a big focus on making sure that if you're in the group, you get some real life experience of what it's like to work in the arts, what it's like to run an arts event. And so it's a great opportunity for those who both want to get creative but also want to get some work experience. So far the group have done quite a bit of both, but all of our circuit events have mostly been at Kettle's Yard or Wising, and the circuit festival happening tomorrow is the first time we've done a large scale, or the first time the group's done a large scale event outside of Kettle's Yard or Wising.
So what a brilliant opportunity. So where did the idea for this festival come from?
As part of the circuit programme, each of the partner galleries has to do a festival. And we were looking at things that maybe we didn't like about Cambridge, or things that we did really like, things that we felt strongly about. And the main one that came up was sort of being unable to access things or reach things. So like housing is really expensive, so it's not something that young people will be able to afford. There's a lot of space in Cambridge that is part of the university, so if you're not part of the university, you feel like you're not allowed there, it's not for you. So looking at ways to deal with those issues creatively, and
so you decided to have this one day festival that's free, and you're aiming this at a certain age group.
Yep. It's for 15 to 25 year olds, which is the focus of the circuit.
So how did you, once you decided that this was the way to address some of those issues, how did you then pin down what was going to happen?
We've been working with a Danish art collective called Superflex, and they've done a lot of community work, so working with the local community to develop the park, or creating a local TV or radio station sort of led by retired people in a tower block, that kind of thing. So they've been really useful in helping us focus on sort of specific things, and then working out a way that we can sort of creatively.
And I think that thing of like community is quite important with this festival, because a lot of, say for the C at the secret location, I have to add, it's, you know, dance, music, film, spoken word poetry, all local acts, all people who are based in Cambridge or around Cambridge. I think it's a really good platform to say, you know, this is what's going on in Cambridge, these are people who are actually doing stuff in Cambridge, from Cambridge. So
if we come along tomorrow, well, first of all, where should we go, and what would we see?
There are two locations during the day. It's Jesus Green, so near the footbridge of the lock, and that's 12 till 5. And we've got a game, which is based a little bit on Angry Birds, but that's throwing ducks to knock over houses.
Not real ducks, obviously.
No, not real ducks. Sort of the yellow ones you have in the bath, don't worry. We wouldn't want to.
No ducks are harmed.
No ducks are harmed in the making of this festival. And sort of came out of the house prices, and sort of that inaccessibility. And then we've also got a workshop. It's looking at how to sort of get around walking in Cambridge because of the difficulty with so many people, particularly sort of new students, or we've got tourists and they don't know where they're going, and sort of a fun way to sort of deal with those issues. And that's, I think I said that's running 12 till 5. And then it's running again from 12 till 5. There are other things happening in the market square, so just in front of the Guildhall, if the weather stays as nice as it is today. We've got a model Cambridge workshop, so rebuilding Cambridge from the ground up, so putting in exactly what you think needs to be there. We've got alternative tours, so looking at different parts of Cambridge in a different way and taking you to places that you wouldn't normally see. And we've got a complaints song, and we're gathering complaints at the same time to then take further and deal with them later.
I really like this because it's all fun and it's all arty, but you are actually saying something as well. You're using this to make a statement.
Definitely.
And we'd really like to use it as an opportunity to collect other young people's views and opinions on the day as well. So we got various activities along the way, which will hopefully get the audience's contributions for that as well, through doing a bit of playful fun and going on some, having a different experience.
And you mentioned, Jacob, I know you can't say too much about it, there's something secret happening at the end of the day. What can you say?
Well, it's going to be like a kind of multidisciplinary night of performance and general artistic greatness.
that's fabulous.
Yeah, so you know, local dance crews, Sin Crew and Elements. We've got a band called Lunacre, and a sort of an electronic trio which I'm in, called Kyriakides, playing. We've also got spoken word from Nikki Marone and Hannah Jane Walker. And is it a photography, kind of photography exhibition?
Yeah, we've also
going?
Got a display of photography that we've been working on, and screenings of various films and photography. And there's some refreshments as well, some art installations. And so it's sort of a celebration of all the group's hard work so far. So it's a bit of I'm calling it an art party.
Well, you mentioned the hard work there. Yes, how long has this taken you to put together?
A long time. It's been a long process. The group's currently about 15 members, so we've all, working with the group, you've got to divide up quite a bit in order to actually get to the production end of things. So we've been working on it. I mean, over a year we've been developing the ideas.
Behind the scenes work,
but the production has been happening over about 4 months.
Yeah, because you're planning virtually a whole day of activities and you want it all to be meaningful. What do you want at the end of it? I mean, not how you measure the success, but perhaps what would you like? What would be your ultimate end outcome? I could say to you tomorrow, was this a success? And you could say, yes, this was a success because...
I'm part of the team that's running the alternative tours, and... I think it would be really great if, you know, we have people that do live in Cambridge, that they live here or they work here, and we've been able to, like, show them different sides of things and encourage them to think about their city in a different way. So,
and this, you said it's 15 to...
25.
25, but
yeah.
People younger, people older, are they allowed to dip in?
Yeah. There are a couple of activities that are a little more sort of guided towards that age group, but we're not going to be strict about it because we don't want it to be exclusive. We want it to be inclusive. We want, you know, everyone to get something from it.
So we should just say to people, get yourselves down to Market Square or Jesus Green tomorrow between 12 and 5 and take part in this.
Yeah, and we have food and drink available as well.
Food and drink, there you are. And is this the first one? Of this festival? Is this the first time you've run this festival?
Yeah, it's the very first time the circus group put on a festival. We will take the theme that we've developed and do further activity around the theme of Unlocking Cambridge next year. But yeah, this is the first festival.
Yeah.
And we'll see if it will be the last.
see how you feel tomorrow evening.
Awesome.
Yeah, have you enjoyed it? Have you enjoyed putting it together?
Yeah.
Definitely.
It's been really great.
Yeah, and it's been, like, really kind of, like, informative as well, like, seeing how, like, we've had some, like, issues with, like, certain spaces and just, like, that those kind of ins and outs, which you wouldn't really know before, but now you feel like you've got, like, a little bit more...
Insight.
Yeah, insight on how to deal with it and how to, like, take problems when it comes up, and, yeah, that's been, well, good.
Yeah.
I suppose you don't know it until you actually put something on, do you? You don't know the practical problems until you actually, as you say, look at space, look at timings.
Yeah, but we've been working with some great artists as well. So, again, local artists that we like be using local bands at the secret location. But they've been really helpful as well because working with people who've got a lot of experience, so we've all learned something from them as well.
And you form new networks, and they form new networks as well.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, good luck for tomorrow. I do hope the weather holds. What is the forecast?
So it said cloudy and slightly warmer than today, but so far no rain.
No rain. That's all you want, isn't it?
We don't want the rain.
That's your bottom line. And if people want to find out more about this, the website to go to is kettlesyard.co.uk/unlock.
Yeah.
That's
and
the one.
Our Twitter and Instagram is CircuitCams with a B, and the hashtag is UnlockCambridge.
The cameras are good, and it's all free.
All free.
And also, the evening section of the festival will run from 6 till 9 o'clock, and you can find out tomorrow the location of that, where the evening party will be, if you go to that website and also our social media, and we will be telling people who come during the daytime where to go in the evening.
Right, so you need to keep your ear to the ground.
Yes.
Well, Tahara, Lou, Jacob, thank you very much for coming to the show.
You're
good luck.
Thank you.
Connecting our city. Cambridge 105. Now on DAB Digital Radio.